Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis, continuing conversations about the cultures of consciousness. I'm currently banging my dissertation into a book, and I've been thinking a lot about weirdness lately for that reason. And one of the things I thought about as I was pursuing the weird in various guises for my research is the general tendency I think people, particularly intellectuals, scholars, scientists, have in relationship to the weird, to anomalous experiences, to the extraordinary. There's definitely a whole bunch of people who are leery of spending too much time looking at these things because they're often elusive, they're rare, they seem, likely to be not what they seem. Perhaps they actually are illusions. They're blips in the data, and that you get more insight and a more coherent worldview by looking at the things that are most regular. And then you also have people who seem obsessively drawn to the bizarre and the anomalous. Here I'm thinking of someone like Charles Fort, who went through the newspapers in the early 20th century looking for reports of strange events and odd experiences like frogs falling from the sky and et cetera. And he amassed this enormous collection of just odd things that even if you believe a lot of them were folklore or misreported, the preponderance of the evidence pointed to something weird that was going on that we don't really have explanations for. And there's a certain kind of person, a certain kind of scientist, a certain kind of intellectual that gets interested in those things as well. And it really does kind of organize your view of the world, how much weight you put these extraordinary events, whether they're things that are happening in the world or things that are happening inside you. And I think we have this tendency in our own lives as well. A lot of our lives, at least a lot of my life, is kind of mundane, a little boring, a little frustrating, kind of same old, same old. And then occasionally there are extraordinary experiences, and it's not always clear how to weight those, do I remember them? Are they the most important parts? Do I tend to go, they don't really have anything to do with my normal life, so I'm just going to let them go. I think we have a lot of extraordinary experiences that unless we're used to recording them and thinking about them and weaving them into our lives, we forget about them and kind of lose out on the richness and possible insight that those things have for us. In scientific study, there's also the idea of the black swan, or to take it the opposite direction, the white crow. And this was William James talked about this when he was studying spiritualism. Is that if you look really hard and with a skeptical mind, most of the seances, most of the extraordinary events that appeared to happen at seances, could be explained or even could be exposed through tricks and magic-like tricks of the mediums. But as James pointed out, all you needed, if these were all black crows, that is, what's predictable, what's expected, that there's a trick, it's just human, it's just normal human life. All you need is one of these things, just one white crow to show that not all crows are black. And that's, again, a kind of a tendency or a predilection that people have. And today's guest on Expanding Mind, Kelly Bulkley, brings this sort of interest in the white crow to the study of dreams, which he's been writing and teaching about and researching in a variety of different ways for quite a long time. He's got quite a number of books, and the new book is called Big Dreams, The Science of Dreaming and the Origins of Religion. And it's precisely these big dreams, i.e. these rare, relatively rare and extraordinary dreams that Kelly's talking about. I think we all have these experiences. Most of our dreams are kind of weird, maybe sort of kind of forgettable. We don't quite remember them in the morning, a little flash here and there. Maybe we remember more of it, but it's a dream about trying to get to work or some odd run-in with some strange character or something. And then occasionally we get these amazing, vivid, sometimes terrifying, sometimes extraordinarily beautiful, sometimes mystical even dreams, and they're very memorable, and often we carry them with us our whole lives. I have dreams that I had when I was a teenager that I still recall and return to as sort of sources of meaning or points of transformation for me, or at least a fascination. So Kelly really uses these dreams to look at dreaming in general, and particularly the relationship between dreams and the history and experience of religion. So I'm very happy to have Kelly on the show. Kelly, thanks so much for joining us on Expanding Mind.
Oh, it's good to be with you. Thanks for having me.
Sure. So I know you've been working on dreams for a long time. How did you first get into them, and how did it relate to your study of religion?
Yeah, well, I came into it through a kind of unlikely collection of circumstances, kind of like you mentioned. As a teenager, I had strange, anomalous types of dreams that nothing in my waking world sort of education and upbringing had prepared me for. And so I kind of began a self-study of drawing on reading books by Freud and Jung and other people in the Bay Area and sort of the late 70s, early 80s, when there was a lot of creative new interest in dreams. I was very lucky to kind of come of age at a time and a place where people like Jeremy Taylor, Patricia Garfield, Gail Delaney, Stephen LeBarge, there were a bunch of really dynamic people doing cool things with dreams just as I was getting interested through my own dream experiences. And so, yeah, it was kind of a good right place at right time, and I found it such a an expansive thing to study. Just you can go in so many directions, draw on so many different fields of research, and you know, you quickly realize, looking into dreams even a little bit, that they're incredibly multifaceted. So no one discipline will ever have the whole story. You need the sort of multidisciplinary approach, and that's been kind of the story of what I've done through my career.
Yeah, well, one of the things that's interesting about your approach is that while you clearly have your roots or your foundation as a thinker about dreams, you know, in these currents of sort of depth psychology with Freud and especially with Jung, and as well as the sort of interest in dreams and altered states that come about in that sort of Bay Area 70s, 80s consciousness culture kind of way, yeah, is that over time you have also got much more interested in cognitive science and the cognitive study of religion, which tends among many of its practitioners to be involved in a much more, I won't say hostile, but critical approach to precisely the value and richness and potential meaningfulness of these kinds of experiences. So that's something in your own development that I'm kind of interested in, is that, and I think you mentioned this in the new book at one point, that initially you were very you were kind of skeptical or concerned about this tendency within the new cognitive science, which is such an important part of the study of religion and study of human beings today. I mean, it's just such a growing field, and that initially you were a little wondering how this was going to help illuminate dreams, which can have such intimate meanings that require such kind of a personal dimension to them. But then in some ways you kind of shifted, or you became more embracing of those approaches. So how did that develop?
Yeah, no, that's a good question, because it does kind of, I've had to do a lot of explaining over the years to some of my colleagues, like, what are you doing now? Why are you going in that direction? And I mean, at a certain point, and pretty early on, I felt there's kind of a scholarly crossroads where I could be kind of critical in orientation and drawing on the background in psychology and religion that was my graduate studies to kind of challenge the rise of cognitive science, evolutionary psychology, neuro this, neuro that. Because there's a lot to critique, right? And I was well-trained to do that. But it felt kind of sterile. And I didn't really like the thought of doing that for 30 or 40 years. That just didn't sound like fun. So what I decided to do instead is kind of channel those critical concerns into efforts to do it better, you know, to show that drawing on new scientific discoveries of how the brain and the mind work are not necessarily reductive or conflicting with some of the core kind of spiritual and religious themes that I think are perennial in human experience. But you gotta get in there and do that work. And so that's what this new book is. At one level is kind of a strong pushback against a certain kind of cognitive scientific study of religion that I think, as you're hinting at, is, you know, sort of new atheist type approach that I think my book is a pretty strong, scientifically grounded response. So.
Yeah, very much. I mean, you stay within naturalism, and you also use the more skeptical critiques as a launching point. You structure your chapters beginning with a kind of more skeptical response to dreaming. Well, we don't really, you know, dreams are just the hard disk of the brain reformatting at night. They're right. It's useless to look at them for meaning. And you're like, okay, well, let's think about what do we actually know about the brain, and what can we actually say about how imagination functions, et cetera, et cetera. And so you build a really nice bridge between these things. And it also struck me that one of the reasons that you sort of began to speak that language more fluidly is also that there are aspects of that approach that are really useful to understanding this, whatever, more meaningful side of dreams, whether we consider that in religious terms or just in terms of people's individual experience. So in terms of your own, like, going deeper into the cognitive science as a framework, what are some of the best things about it that help your work in terms of understanding these connections?
Yeah, well, this is where, you know, I stay within a naturalistic framework, because naturalism is much weirder than most people realize. I mean, and this is where I do start each chapter with my best effort to articulate a certain kind of skeptical question about the study of dreams and religion and such. There are many such questions. And what I try to show is that a lot of what passes for kind of, you know, mainstream scientific views of dreams is really pretty shallow and not actually based on what current scientific research and just basic mainstream stuff. I'm not making it up. I'm citing, you know, well-established findings in a variety of fields, all of which point to the mind and the brain being incredibly active during the whole course of the sleep cycle. And so that's, if you're interested in dreams from a kind of experiential perspective and the creativity and the wonder that comes in dreaming, if you now know that the brain is doing these incredibly complex and sophisticated and in many ways mysterious things during sleep, it's got to make you wonder if there's a connection. And so that to me is really kind of throwing down the gauntlet a little bit to the cognitive science of religion by saying, hey, if you're really interested in studying religious phenomena using cognitive scientific resources, dreams should be part of that conversation. And if they are part of that conversation, maybe that makes some of the other studies of rituals and meditation and beliefs in God and the afterlife and other things that cognitive scientists have studied, maybe that creates different ways of looking at those phenomena too. So I really am trying to constructively contribute to that conversation, which if I pick up what you're saying, I think I agree is kind of gone astray in a lot of ways. But it doesn't have to. I don't think that's necessary.
I totally agree with you. I mean, I'm thinking in your book of one example that kind of clarifies that approach is you have a section about prophetic dreams. And so you talk about, look, if we look through religions all around the world, you're going to find a great deal of emphasis on people, you know, seeking dreams for oracles, for insights into the future, people having these dreams, you know, making statements based on them, creating things. And from a kind of hard-edged new atheist cogsci perspective, this of course is all just complete delusion. It's taking some, you know, ephemeral froth from the defragging hard drive of the mind and turning it into some way of manipulating and lying to people. But then then you point out, you're like, hey, but actually a lot of what our brains do all during our waking day is to forecast. We are always thinking about the future. We're planning, we're scheduling, we're framing, we're running possibilities. And the brain keeps doing that at night too. And we're engaged with time and potential and history, but we just do it with different parts of the brain, more visual sections of the brain, more imagery. So you get these rich, you know, image visions of the future, which can actually have some kind of, not prophetic in a supernatural sense, but they can be gesture towards possibilities and potentials that maybe aren't as visible to the waking mind. So there's a way in which they can fit into a more naturalistic understanding that takes the phenomena seriously, if not literally.
Yeah. I mean, it's easy to dismiss the whole thing by saying, oh, people treat dreams like magic eight balls, you know, like, you know, telling you do this or don't do that, or predicting a plane's going to crash tomorrow, that's just kind of a silly conversation. I think that it becomes much more understandable when, as you say, we kind of think of not, you know, the brain and mind during waking, the brain and mind in sleep, but kind of the brain and mind during its cycle of activities, and what we now know from evolutionary theory and developmental psychology, how our minds and brains emerge exquisitely attuned to predicting and anticipating the future. Like, that's something humans are really good at. We're better at that than all other species, and we benefit from it. And so that capacity, which is so kind of distinctively human, is going to be part of what the brain and mind are doing the whole cycle, and how we tease out which aspects are at play at any given time is part of it. But just that basic recognition, I think, sort of demystifies to an extent the idea that dreams can have a meaningful engagement with the future, with things that are possibilities that are ahead in our lives. I am trying to make that a more understandable while still leaving open the door to weird stuff. Because, I mean, you know, you hear super weird things. It just that it's hard to imagine what the naturalistic framework would be that would accommodate that. But you know, just keep that one in the Charles Fort file and see what comes.
Yeah, I mean, that's always been the approach that we talk about in a lot of different ways just on this show, is kind of that style where you rigorously keep the door open distrust the move to just completely reduce things to the predictable and the understandable, but you know it's still that's the important language to speak right now. I don't think it's a time to defend the weirder or the more mysterious or mystical sides of human life through some kind of old traditional language or something. I don't think that's really where we're at, and I think it's more interesting to point to that edge where, as you say, that nature or naturalism is weirder than you think it is in the first place. You know, and then another approach that you have in your book that's really fresh and that's also more hard science friendly is your approach to statistics, because of course one of the problems with dreams is it's based on individual reporting and everybody has their own way of using language. You can't really get it like the content data of dreams in a really robust way that would make us, you know, strict experimentalists feel really comfortable with that as a data set. But you can look at large collections, big data of dreams. So your big dreams are also kind of about big data, and develop inferences and ways of understanding dreaming and the function of dreaming and the role it plays in people's lives by looking at these large collections of dreams. So talk about that whole big data approach and when you, how you started it. And I know you got a database running and that side of your work is really, really interesting.
Yeah. Well, thanks. And that is kind of the backbone, I suppose, of the Big Dreams book, kind of the research and the studies that I draw out of that sleep and dream database. You know, it goes back to kind of the original dream nerds of history, people like Artemidorus, ancient Roman, and even Cyrene, the great Muslim interpreter. And there have been great sort of encyclopedists of dreaming through history in pretty much every literate culture. And I kind of think of myself in that lineage as well, people who try to gather as many dreams and reports of dreams and descriptions and theories of dreams and try to perceive and tease out these bigger patterns. And I'm lucky enough to live at a time when digital technology is suddenly amplifying the powers to do what other dream researchers, I'll call them that, dream encyclopedists, have been doing with, you know, quill and ink and parchment and such for centuries, for millennia. So that's, to me, the important context, is that this is a kind of a continuing effort that other people recognize that as much as we can learn from particular dreams, from individual dreams, whole new realms of potential meaning emerge when we're able to look at dreams, big collections of dreams, large data sets that allow some of these patterns and themes to emerge. So that's you know, something that it's, I think, is a you know, kind of a core tenet or a core approach in the study of dreams historically. And it took me a while to come around to that, because the main quantitative approach to the study of dreams for most of the 20th century was the Holland-Vandekassel content analysis system. And that always, from the beginning, struck me as very reductive, so analytical that the dream was sort of chopped up into these little atomized bits, and, you know, where was the meaning, where was the life of the dream? And what I've come around to believe, and this is thanks in large part to Bill Domhoff, a psychology professor at UC Santa Cruz, who preserves kind of the Holland-Vandekassel system and really has shown good ways of using it. He's helped me kind of come to a point where I realize I can use some of those tools just for more interesting kinds of questions I find more interesting, more culturally, spiritually, psychologically interesting kinds of questions. So, yeah, the book is trying to use the tools that other quantitative scientists use, but just trying to answer different questions. And I think the answers are, yeah, kind of interesting once you give that a try.
Well, one of the things that really struck me was you talked about how much information you could gain about an individual based on certain statistical patterns in their dreaming. And so you give a few examples of, and so now we're not talking about large populations, but just individuals. You know, you were given a sort of, you know, raft of dream data from what you knew, was all you knew about it was a young man. And the data wasn't even the text of the actual dreams. It was the sort of, you know, second order collection of word frequencies and things like that. And you were able to infer, you know, some reasonably specific stuff about that person's life and social status and relationship status and things like that. So that's really kind of remarkable when you think about it. It's slightly creepy even. But so talk a little bit about how that process worked and why it is the case that that people can infer those kinds of concrete situations even from statistical patterns in an individual or group streaming.
Yeah. Well, part of that is based on kind of a working hypothesis that we call the continuity hypothesis, that that the frequency that you dream about something is an index of how important emotionally or whatever that thing is in your waking life. So, you know, example I often use, if you're, you know, closer to your brother than your sister, you're likely to dream more of your brother than your sister. That frequency of appearance in a dream is kind of an accurate mirror of an emotional engagement in the waking world. And using that hypothesis, that lets you make some predictions based on dream data. So if you've got some dream data and you look at it with that hypothesis in mind and you look for variations and things that appear frequently and things that appear very infrequently, you can make some predictions that Bill Dalmoff and I and some other people are finding can be reasonably accurate, you know. And why that's exciting is it helps establish, I mean, you know, this is one of those basic skeptical questions. How do you know there's any, you know, intrinsic meaning in dreams? How do you know that you're not just imagining faces and shapes in the clouds? You know, you're projecting. And this kind of study where I'm not even looking at the dreams, right? Like you say, I'm only looking at these word usage frequency patterns to be able to say, oh, that set of dreams correlates to X, Y, and Z attributes of the person in the waking world. That's, I think, and Bill Dalmoff and others think, that's pretty good evidence that there is something in the dreams themselves, that it's not just, I mean, this is a kind of study that anybody could perform, any person, any kind of, just doing, performing the same kinds of word searches, the same results emerge. So that's exciting. It's sort of at a very research-oriented level. I hear you on kind of the creep factor, because it is. It's like, huh, well, if that, I mean, that's like, how far does that go? And what else can you find out? And what's the responsibility of the interpreter to share that or sort of help the dreamer process that if something comes up? You know, there's, and I'm very aware of that, and I guess, you know, all I can say at this point is I'm trying to figure out where these tools can be used and how they can be used in ways that hopefully will make sense within a dream research context rather than, you know, kind of the gold rush mentality of the internet and you know, the World Wide Web, where, you know, people are already monkeying around with dream interpretation apps and symbol dictionaries and such. And
well, yeah, it's like so much of this stuff is that the very tools that let us gather much more data are often set up in a way that the data gets outside of that particular use, and then it, you know, so then you can imagine like a really cool, you know, online dream database where people are coding their dreams, and so like the patterns are developing and people can ask different kinds of questions about it, like location, are there certain dreams, do suddenly like everybody dreamed about a tidal wave in this one right. area, and like what would that, you know, all these, I mean, there's so many fascinating things you can do, but taking, you know, the ability to this continuity thesis, you can imagine a marketer being able to like go in there and go, oh yeah, okay, this is great. So this community, we can hit them with this message and, you know, whatever. It's like, and that's just the way that so many of our data tools are. It's a really strange, it's like the two-edged sword is always, you know, right in front of us. But I wanted to ask you more about what are some other things you can imagine, like, you know, speculate a little bit. Imagine a really like a rote, if you had a lot of, you got a good research grant and you got some really great tools and a great team. What are some of the things that you could take to the next level in terms of this database approach?
Yeah, well you've already listed a couple of the, I mean, there are several groups, and I've been a consultant to some of them, that are creating online dream journaling systems that allow some degree of big data analytics, which are cool. And I've been, what I've tried to develop for myself, just sort of thinking about what are the resources I've got and sort of the best contribution I can make to this. And what I've really tried to focus on is providing the best empirical foundations for any kind of, you know, really advanced developments in this area. And the problem with drawing on data that's basically user-generated is that that's just not and except for very limited purposes, that's not great data for building solid, strong empirical scientific arguments. It's not utterly useless, I wouldn't say, but user, and trust me, I've seen a lot of user-generated data from Dream Sites, and it's tough to work with and dubious in terms of whatever conclusions you draw from it. So what I really tried to do is, like Bill Domhoff, using really systematically gathered collections of dreams and trying to tease out baseline patterns that then can be used reliably and confidently to develop second-order applications. So I'm kind of trying to do that first-order work, and that I imagine that's going to take a while still, although this book is kind of the first big step in that direction. But what would those second-order applications be? I mean, certainly in the realm of therapy and healthcare, I could totally imagine, you know, I've written a little about this, a kind of system where a client would regularly enter his or her dreams into a system that the therapist would have access to and would be able to receive some kind of automatically generated observations about patterns in the dreams that wouldn't remove the need for the therapist. And this is key with kind of any kind of second order application. In my view, I follow Clive Thompson and kind of the Centaur model that machines and digital resources can help humans do what humans are best at. You know, so a therapist would have that information. A therapist wouldn't have to go through and code all the dreams and count up this, that, and the other thing and calculate the statistics. No, in my vision here, that there'd be a system, an app of some sort that would generate that for the therapist. So then when you've got that precious time of the client and the therapist in a room together talking it out, all that analytic work has been done and they can go from there. That becomes a starting point, not sort of the work itself. And to me, and I'm pretty sure most therapists I know have helped me think about this, we'll be psyched to have that. So that's certainly one area. I mean, similar kinds of coaching, training applications I could see in the realm of sports, art or creativity, problem solving. I imagine there'd be something, because that continuity hypothesis really works well on the relational level, sort of the people that we relate to, the social world. I think there'd be some sort of, I don't want to say like a relationship app, but something where people could kind of take the temperature of their various relationships through a process of tracking their dreams over time. I think that most people, when they, you know, keep a long-term journal, that's the thing that they find is cool, is sort of seeing how their personal relations in waking life kind of ebb and flow with the characters who appear and don't appear in their dream. So
right.
See that too, yeah.
Well, so we've been talking about the sort of continuity hypothesis, the connection between patterns in dreaming and the circumstances of everyday life. But of course, at the same time, dreams also provide lots of evidence for discontinuity. You know, when you have dreams of extraordinary experiences that you've never had, that you maybe you've never even read about, other worlds, other beings, time slips, all of the weird stuff, the bizarre stuff that happens inside dreams, and that's just as important to the story that you're telling, particularly because a lot of the big dreams you're talking about, those really vivid, memorable, sometimes life-changing dreams that people have this other quality as well, something mystical, something extraordinary, something demonic. So talk about a little bit about how you get, you know, from the sort of continuity approach that recognizes there is some meaning in dreams because it's clearly tied in with your daily circumstances. But then there's also something to be said for the value of this weird stuff, that it's not just, again, the hard drive defragging itself. There's something going on here, a number of things going on, and you point to a number of different zones. But how does the story shift when you start to pay attention to the weird and the extraordinary aspects of dreams?
We've kind of laid the foundations for that, and kind of my premise in this particular book project was the best, you know, a good way to understand what's extraordinary about big dreams is to get a very clear, scientifically legitimate sense of what ordinary dreams are like. What is the baseline of general sort of average normal dreaming, which the continuity hypothesis helps us really lay out in very satisfying detail, I think. And so what that does is then gives us this great perspective on what emerges in these, you know, what Carl Jung originally referred to as big dreams, sort of, you know, either unusual in their emotions or their images or their themes or their settings. And that often leads also beyond this kind of literal continuity, as you say, into the realm of metaphor and symbolism and the realization, which we kind of said at the outset, anybody who really works with dreams at all, you realize, wow, there's so many different layers of meaning and significance here. Some of it, you know, seemingly literal and kind of direct. Other aspects, much more elusive, ambivalent. Things aren't you know, clear black and white necessarily. And so how can we study those dimensions of dreams, which are real, but hard to study in a scientific way? So how do we go about that? And this is where, you know, I employ this notion of reverse engineering, where we look at a mental attribute or a mental experience, and we try to figure out, well, what would be the kind of mind-brain functions and attributes that would make that kind of thing possible. And so that's what I try to do in the main part of the book, looking at dreams that have extreme emotions, either very fearful emotions, people being, you know, chased or attacked. Chasing dreams are a very common, in a way, type of big dream that a lot of people, particularly in childhood, have those kinds of dreams. Intense sexual dreams are another kind of big dreams where there's this strong physiological response, very powerful arousing sensations, very memorable. You know, that kind of dream experience, we actually understand how, you know, that's not a, you know, there are stories about the supernatural qualities of what goes on around those dreams. Having dreams like that, actually, we can understand in terms of how the mind and the body and the brain all work during the course of the sleep cycle. And the same with you know, what I generally refer to in the book as mystical dreams that involve people who are dead returning as if they're alive, flying dreams, breathing underwater, magical powers, scenes of extraordinary beauty. These kinds of dreams, again, they have these transcendent qualities and stimulate religious and spiritual and philosophical thought in all cultures. I mean, this is just it's such a widespread phenomenon. But that's not in any way to take away from how we can see those dream experiences having pretty well understood roots in how the mind and the brain work during sleep. So to me, it's kind of a great example of how religion and science can work together every now and then. I mean, it's a case where you can really see how these experiences generate all sorts of religious and spiritual thinking and beliefs. And how could you not? If you have an intense visitation dream of someone who has died but comes back, that's a very natural thought process. And yet we can also really clearly see how you know, the way the mind works during the sleep cycle, that's not a completely unexpected or impossible product of you know, the cognitive activities of the mind in sleep. So that's kind of the nub of the argument, is that connection, really there's no need to oppose the different realms of its explanation as
well. Well, let's take just the example that your category of the mystical dream. So this includes speaking with the dead, and also includes, you know, dreaming of flying, which is, you know, something people have, but also just a general sense of a kind of transcendent force. In my experience, those dreams are often marked by extraordinary vivid color. Like, a lot of my ordinary dreams aren't that colorful, and then I'll have one that's, you know, exquisitely beautiful. And I often have exquisitely beautiful sections in the dream that's often the most memorable. I don't, you know, get the whole story, but I'm in a temple, and it's like the statues are incredibly intricate. And just that fact alone, that we can, even if it's just our, you know, just our brains, no big deal, nothing fancy, nothing supernatural, just the fact that we can see and witness such extraordinary beauty and have this sense of wonder or sense of awe. If from a naturalistic point of view, and I know you've written about wonder also in your earlier work, also tends to be something that the cognitive science, you know, the reductive people don't look at so much. They're interested in fear. They're interested in lust. You know, those make sense. Wonder and awe, that's a little harder to figure out. What is the natural, what's the adaptive function that has? How does that fit into a naturalist account? So how do you approach that?
Yeah, well, that's, so I think you're absolutely right that the tendency of many cognitive scientists who've looked at religion have tended to look at, like you say, things like fear or affiliation or belief in particular concepts. Like, it doesn't, there's been relatively little attention to, yes, more mystical kinds of emotion. There's a fair amount of research on meditation from a neuroscientific point of view, and that's very cool research, and I talk a bit about that in the book when I get into lucid dreaming. But yeah, the sort of the mystical experiences that people associate with wonder and awe, I mean, those are definitely attributes of almost all big dreams. I mean, that kind of bringing in that earlier research I've done on wonder. I mean, even the most frightening nightmares often have this kind of penumbra of wonder. It's like, oh my God, what was that? Where did that come from? The kind of the sense of overwhelming surprise that I think is an important element of wonder. So for me, the best way to understand that within a kind of this naturalistic framework that I'm, kind of weird naturalistic framework that I'm trying to use and show how things can work within that, is that such experiences are kind of keeping our minds, our very formidable, thinking operations, keeping them fresh and open and aware of any and all possibilities. And I guess this is why I think these dreams in some ways are kind of the crystallizations of what dreaming is in general. I mean, I think dreaming in general is a constant challenge to the waking mind to stay open, to avoid premature closure, premature rigidity, premature attachment to anything now, because you don't know what's going to come next. And as I said earlier, I think a lot of research on evolutionary psychology makes it clear that this is one thing humans are really good at. We are good at adaptive and flexible responses to unexpected future developments. And dreams of intense wonder and intense awe, I think, are kind of giving a kind of an experiential boost to how deeply pleasurable and important it is to have those feelings, to find those feelings, to stay open and seek out new things. I think that's where these dreams will often be an inspirational source for various kinds of religious and mythological beliefs, because they feel deeply real, like you're really tuning into something real when you have those experiences. And I think that's as hardwired into us as anything could be.
Sure, sure. And also, it's just, to make the point, you also say it in your conclusion, and I totally agree with this, that dreams are also a place where we can see the origins of skepticism, along with the origins of religion. I mean, the classic story of Chuangzi and the butterfly, am I a butterfly dreaming of a man, or am I a man dreaming of a butterfly? There's something about the way we move from the dream world to the waking world and have to deal with that gap, that crack, and that is a way, an aspect of critical thinking, too. And that just sort of leads me to my next question, which is, one of the things that I learned from your book and from other things I've read, but you talk about it quite, you bring it up quite often, is that that we really have the full range of thinking in our dreams. It's not simply that they're the experience of wonder and overwhelming pleasure and impulse and fear. It's that there's also cognition and metacognition, thinking about thinking, reflection, a concept, associational conceptual thinking goes on all the time, and that this is particular. This is one way we can understand what you mentioned earlier about lucid dreams, which of course is one of the main things that people love to talk about when they talk about dreaming is lucid dreaming. And rather than just going, "Oh yeah, it's great, you can learn it," and then when you do it, it's really fun and ecstatic and whatever. But what does it really mean? Well, it means that there's some capacity we have to think about thinking, to reflect on ourselves within the dream world as well, and that tells us some very profound things about the brain and how thought operates in these sort of altered zones where we're disconnected from the sensual universe to a great degree. So how do those things fit together, the different aspects of cognitive thinking that go on in dreaming, and particularly how that leads to lucid dreaming?
No, that's a good way of introducing that whole line of research, because as you say, it's what we're finding is that the kind of the mental landscape of dreaming is different from waking in many ways, but the same things that happen in anything that happens in waking seems to be able to happen potentially in dreaming. All types of thought are found in dreaming, maybe not as often as in waking. But what that tells me is that kind of the dreaming imagination has the full palette of cognitive abilities at its disposal. And lucid dreaming is sort of the clearest example of that, where even full self-awareness, the sense that I'm my body is asleep in bed, but I'm aware and dreaming in the sleep state. So this really shows, I think, the potentials of the mind in the sleep state. And lucid dreaming, and that's we got a whole conversation about sort of what how that's emerged, why it's so appealing to certain people in contemporary Western societies, pros and cons of different applications. What I think is interesting kind of in this context is how it really demonstrates the open potentials that we're just scratching the surface of. And kind of going back to the, kind of the database work and applications, like there's kind of the base level work, like I said, there's the kind of the secondary applications, therapy, sports, whatever. But those second order things are basically trying to figure out how to use new dream information for things we already do or want to do. Kind of the third order, the next level, is kind of looking at these dream attributes that emerge in things like lucid dreams and saying, what new things emerge. Not just, you know, trying to use dreams to do things we've always tried to do. Now that we're gaining this deeper and more kind of data-driven perspective on our own dreams and dreaming in general, what entirely new paths can we pursue? And that's the big question. And lucid dreamers and people who experiment with consciousness in various ways, I think, are kind of the pioneers in this, because that's really where I think this field is poised to go. If we can kind of, going back to that early foundation, kind of really understand what the best scientific information we can find tells us about that basic foundational set of activities, and then what can we do with them?
In that sense, dreaming is another aspect of what people are coming to call consciousness hacking. This kind of new way of exploring altered states that's kind of like, in a way like the 70s 2.0, like it's like the digital, because in the 70s there was, and in the 80s there was so much experimental psychology about altered states because of the counterculture and biofeedback devices, and people were measuring yogis and all that stuff was going on, but it was in a very different time with a different kind of framework. And it feels like in a lot of ways what we're doing is kind of coming back to those same possibilities. You know, one foot in naturalism and maybe keeping the door open for weird possibilities, but with a lot more sense of rigor and interest in technology and interest in what do we do with the data, how do we present the data. You know, just a more sort of scientifically self-aware process, but at the same time it's fueled by a very similar sense of a real desire to explore. Like, we're not just, even though we were sitting here, we're talking ideas, et cetera, et cetera. The reason this stuff is really interesting is because people still want to explore. I mean, they really want to go out there and use these new tools to explore in new ways and discover new things. And that, it feels like that's one part of our moment that I find very hopeful and very interesting. And I know you've given talks at consciousness hacking gatherings, and you are aware of these other zones that maybe aren't about dreaming, but they're about altered states or biofeedback or meditation or yoga, all this sort of other things that are going on. Does it feel to you like that something's kind of interesting that's happening on a larger level outside of your own field?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. No, I think it's super encouraging, because, I think you're right about the kind of the historical through line there, and which I would trace back. I mean, we could talk about the transcendentalists and like there's a deep history to this kind of experimental approach to conscious exploration, and I think where the dream research comes into play and is helpful is highlighting a couple of things that we know about what's going on neurologically in dreams, and I think really clearly have some connection or other to other kinds of altered states. Most traditions find that the dreams can kind of be woven into any kind of practical. I mean, there's sort of a whatever your pursuit is, your dreams are probably going to have something to say about it, So it doesn't hurt. It doesn't mean that becomes your number one focus, but, it could help to have some familiarity with some of the things that occur in dreams, particularly for people who are pushing their boundaries, in new directions. And there's also something, pleasantly kind of natural about dreaming. Like, it's not like we all do it. It's kind of it's not a virtuoso kind of practice. It's not something that, and it can become that, but it's also sort of a small d democratic in the sense of offering access to all people, all ages, all backgrounds. Dreaming is a resource. I mean, it's one of the reasons people who are in power, you know, are often skeptical towards dreams because, you know, that's, they can't control them. And you know, people who are low in the totem pole have dreams that sometimes are relevant to the whole group that shake things up. So that's something I like about dreams. In the broader context of studying altered states and different modes of consciousness. But I think this is a super exciting time. I'm really interested. I mean, the kind of work you're doing, and I know a lot of your guests, your other shows do. I mean, I think it's all just this is the pioneering work of our time. And you know, as long as everyone just is careful, you know, just kind of checks in with each other, and you know, in my work at least, you know, really trying to be transparent about, you know, where I get my data, how I do my analyses, you know, letting people check things, look at it, pack it, you know, do different things with it. Those kind of general principles, I think, help everyone get along and help the cause. So,
yeah, and I also just wanted to, since you are, you do have this database. We didn't talk too much about the details of it. We just got a minute here left. Whether you people listening, if you can, you have an invitation to people if they want to get involved in that aspect of your work.
Sure. Yeah. Thanks. Yeah. The Sacred Dream Database .org is out there, and it's got a lot of search tools, a lot of readings, and things you can, you know, learn about how I and other people are doing, you know, analytic work with large collections of dreams. I'm totally interested in people who have collections of dreams that they want to study and analyze, and, you know, look me up and we can talk about how to make that happen, because that's where a lot of the cool new research is really emerging. So, yeah.
Great. And then also, Kelly's got a blog at kellybulkley.org, and his last name, KellyBulkley.org. Well, Kelly, thanks so much for joining me on Expanding Mind. Your book's really terrific, and best of luck with it.
Yeah, no, it's great. You definitely picked up on the really, you know, not everybody is sort of tuned into some of these broader conversation, so it's fun to talk to someone who really is. That's great. Thanks.
Great. Okay. All right, folks. Well, let's see. What are we doing next week? You know, I always forget what I'm doing next week when I get to this point. I think we're talking to Jeremy Crawford of Wizards of the Coast about D&D. But in any case, until then, keep your minds open.